Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of In the Black. This is the market recap for January 28th. The week has just ended. It is Friday, and we have seen a lot, and I mean a lot of volatilities in the market. The market has been very choppy. We kind of expected this with the Fed still threatening to raise interest rates. Quickly want to recap the outcome of the FOMC meeting with Jerome Powell and all the things he had to say that really seemed to rally the markets a little bit. We were down most of the week. We rallied back today. Today at close, the NASDAQ was up roughly close to 3.13%. The Dow was up 1.65%. S&P was up 2.43%. But once again, it was another choppy trading day. And by choppy, I mean the volatility of the price going up and down, moving well more than 1% intraday is very, very choppy and very volatile indeed. The NASDAQ still overall is down a little over 14% since its all-time highs in November, which we can kind of say, can't say concretely, because usually a bear market technically means 20% off all-time highs. But we are down 14%, and you can confidently, you know, say that we are entering a bearish or bear market. With the S&P and the Dow Jones, they're still down big time, but it's not as bad. With the S&P, I believe we are down 7.54% since the start of the year, and the Dow Jones is down 4.83%. So, like I said last episode, there's really no places, very few places that you can rotate your money into and not just flat out lose. There's some winners, but there's a lot, and I mean a lot of losers. NASDAQ and tech stocks, growth stocks have been hit extremely hard. We have some companies that even despite posting great earnings, for instance, Tesla, I mean, they posted a major beat on their earnings on, Wednesday. They still got bludgeoned in the aftermarket into the next trading day. They were down 11 to 12%. That's a lot for a company that beat all analysts' expectations. So what we're seeing is that there's a really high correlation to stocks that are tanking hard that have a lot of perceived as risk or forward evaluations. By forward evaluations, I mean you're buying the stock at these elevated prices based off what they will do in the future, not necessarily how much money they're making here and now. They could be making some money, but you're buying the stock based on what you think they'll be worth in the future. So you're pricing in some of that price into the current stock price. So that's why you see some of these tech stocks, which are usually the stocks that grow more explosively, because the big difference between tech and value, tech stocks, they usually don't pay dividends. And the reason they don't pay dividends is because they take all that money and profit that they get and they reinvest it back into R&D and further developing new product lines and expanding the business at a rapid pace. Whereas traditional value stocks, you say Coca-Cola or Johnson & Johnson, Procter & Gamble, insurance companies like MetLife, things that are more traditional in nature, those companies tend to pay off their profits as dividends to their investors. So their stocks don't appreciate at a the stock price doesn't appreciate at the same level a tech stock would, but you do get those dividends, but you're pretty much left with a stock that can be a little stagnant in terms of price appreciation. It's not going to grow nowhere near as fast as the tech sector. But like we see with the tech sector, there are high-flying stocks, and there a lot of them are good companies, but they're not as profitable now as their price would suggest. And for a while, that had been fine, pretty much since 2018 coming into 2019, these stocks have been trading above ahead of their PE ratios. That's why the PE ratios are so high. And by PE ratios, I mean their profit to earnings ratio. But, you know, they've been growing and growing and making money. And some of these companies were not profitable at first, but have become profitable. And that's why you invest in these high flying tech stocks. It's like trying to get in, people are trying to find the next Amazon, you know, buying Amazon when it first came out or buying Apple when it first came out. People are looking forward trying to find these companies that are going to be once-in-a-generation companies that are going to change the landscape of, you know, commerce as we know it. So people are willing to pay ahead for price appreciation, pay now for that ahead-of-time price appreciation. And that's why these tech stocks are people are getting more risk-off, or they say risk-averse, they're moving their money away from that tech sector. And the reason all of this is happening is because the Federal Reserve has been posturing. They've been hawkish. If you've heard that Federal Reserve Jerome Powell, the Fed chair, has been hawkish, that means they've been really aggressive at saying they're going to increase rates, as saying they're going to taper asset purchasing, which means slow down the purchasing of assets that the Federal Reserve actually owns. And they're going to start offloading those assets and selling those assets and moving them off their balance sheet. So why is that a big deal, right? Those three things, purchasing assets, maintaining those assets on the balance sheet, and raising rates, directly have a correlation on how expensive it is to borrow money and how much free floating money is available in the economy. So the most important thing you need to know is when the Fed raises interest rates. So I think a big misconception is that the federal government, you think Congress, you think they're the ones that print the money. That's not true. The Fed prints the money. The Federal Reserve actually dictates how much money gets created out of thin air, right? It's not Congress, it's the Federal Reserve. And what happens is the United States government, and it's a little weird because the Federal Reserve is a quasi-government entity, not 100% government, it's not 100% private. But what happens is when the United States wants to borrow money, they go to the Fed and say, hey, we want to borrow, you know, $1 trillion. And what the Fed does is it creates money out of thin air. It says, here's this money at a certain fixed percentage rate. Right now, for the past few years since the pandemic level, they call it quantitative easing. They've just been reducing the rate of to borrow money for the Federal Reserve and for these other big institutions to close to zero. So now that the government is kind of messed up, if you think about it, the government is asking the Fed to create money out of thin air and then borrow that money at almost no interest, right? The reason that's important is because the United States a treasury bond from the Fed is considered, right, a risk-free, right, as close to a risk-free loan as you can get, right? Everybody believes that no matter what, a borrowing from the Fed is a risk-free loan. So what does that mean, right? So if borrowing from the Fed is a risk-free loan that only the United States government, other countries and major institutions can do, right, major banking institutions can do, that's considered a risk-free loan. Every other loan is going to have some kind of risk. If I give you a loan for your car, right, your auto loan, that carries some kind of risk if you defaulting on your loan. If I give you some kind of loan for your house, it carries some kind of risk if you defaulting on a loan. If I give you a loan for a credit card, which are just essentially microloans, right, they come with some kind of risk. Usually with a car, the risk is somewhat, your risk is somewhat mitigated by the fact that the car has value and they could come and repo that. Same thing with your house. Your house has a value. They can come and foreclose and take that back. Credit card, the reason why the interest rates are so high on that is because they can't just come back and get, you know, that vacation you took. You know, they can't come back and, you know, get all the food you ate when you went out to restaurant entertainment. It's hard for them to recapture those things. That's why they come at such a high interest rate. But the whole overall, you know, goal is if the Fed's at this low, low interest rate for creating money and lending it out to other people, then all other loans, the floor starts right above what the Fed's interest rates are. So now that we know that the floor starts right above the Fed interest rates, if the Federal Reserve increases that interest rate, what happens? Every other loan, their interest rate has to climb to stay in lockstep with it. They're not going to ever go below what the Federal Reserve's loan rate is because the Federal Reserve is almost like a guarantee, right? So they're always going to go up and move up a notch higher at the same level that the Fed issues those interest rates at. And that's important to know, especially if you're looking into, let's say, buying your first home. Well, these mortgages are going to start getting more expensive. You know, if you're looking at getting an auto loan, that auto loan is going to start getting more expensive once the Fed raises the rates. But what happened in the meeting on Wednesday, Jerome Powell came out and said that they're not raising rates for January. They're more eyeing March as a potential date when they actually start to raise interest rates and maybe start offloading some of those things off their asset sheet and taper and stop purchasing assets and adding to the asset sheet. But when they raise those rates in March, they'll either raise it 25 or 50 basis points. When I say 50 basis points, That's like if I say 25 basis points, it's 0.25%. 50 basis points is 0.50%. A lot of people think, well, you'll get different estimates. Some people think they're going to raise it 25 basis points. Some people think they're going to raise it 50 basis points. I'm of the opinion that it'll probably be around 25, but I mean, at this point, no one knows. The Fed, his, you know, Jerome Powell's tone was pretty hawkish, saying that they would do whatever they needed to do to address, you know, inflation. And their major tool to combat inflation is raising interest rates. Raising interest rates slows down the economy. It slows down the velocity of money, because when interest rates get high, people are less likely to take on debt. So that's one of their major tools to slow the rapidly increasing inflation that we're facing here in America. And really worldwide is to really just slow down, try to slow down the free flowing of money and slow down the economy. So you're going to start seeing those interest rates climb in March. People had originally been predicting that they're only going to do 3, maybe 4 interest rates hikes this year. Now I'm reading articles where Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs are all projecting now anywhere between 5 to 7 rate hikes this year. That is a big difference. So if the Fed actually gets that hawkish and raises rates that fast, you're going to see a lot of volatility in the marketplace. You're going to see the price of the interest rates on loans go up a lot in a short amount of time. But I think what's going to happen is, even though they raise these interest rates, they're going to have to lower them back down again. And the reason is the United States government, you know, Congress is spending and improving. They're constantly raising the debt ceiling, which means they can borrow more money. Right. That's why it's a big thing about the debt ceiling. They have to raise the debt ceiling because they have to borrow more money because they have to pay their bills. Right. What's happening is we're running at a deficit as a nation. So when you think about it, right. So if usually the way a government is able to pay its obligations and continue to function as a government, you know, and do all the goods it needs for societies, roads, bridges, streets, military, etc., usually your taxpayer dollars will cover that. Well, what's been happening is we aren't making enough off of tax revenue in order to cover those bills. And as the government continues to make more and more programs, right, continues to increase the military, increase other government programs and spending, what happens is we have to borrow that money, right? So where do we borrow that money? From the Fed, from the Federal Reserve. So if the Fed, you know, has been having to lower the interest to close to zero in order to accommodate all this spending that the government is doing, well, you know, it'll raise rates, but after a while, the government's going to say, hey, we need to borrow another $1 trillion. The Fed's going to not, you know, the government's going to say, you need to drop those rates because we can't afford to pay you back at such and such interest for this $1 trillion you're about to give us, if, you know, if they can pay you back at all. So now we see kind of the fallacy of money, right? It's literally created out of thin air. It's backed by the confidence of our, you know, of our government. And, you know, that's why if you're like a Bitcoin maximalist, you know, that's why they believe what they believe, because, you know, the dollar used to be backed by a standard of gold. It's not on the gold standard anymore. It's backed by the confidence in the United States government. So be that as it may, you know, money will continue to inflate because government's going to have to keep having to borrow. It's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy at this point. It's a cycle that there's really no way to get out of. So while I do think that we will be raising rates in the short term and the long term, you know, whether it be the end of this year or sometime into next year, 2023, I believe that they'll have to start slashing rates in order to accommodate all the extra government spending. Because one thing our government, we know to do is to continue to spend more money. And the only other option that the government will have is to drastically increase taxes. And no way any politician is going to do that because they want to stay in office. So this is going to be a rough period of time. It's going to be very choppy. It's going to be choppy in not only, you know, the stock market, but also the crypto market. One thing to note for talking about crypto, one thing to note is the end of the month, January 28th. So January 28th is the last Friday of the month, and that's when a lot of these contracts, these future contracts for Bitcoin come to a close. Interesting thing to note, if Bitcoin closed today above 38K, a lot of the bulls, by bulls I mean people who want the price of Bitcoin to go up, they'll be in the money and they'll be able to collect on a lot of the shorts. But if it closes under 38K, then of course the shorts will be able to rake in a lot of money from the people who are longs or people who are bullish on the Bitcoin price. So it's a big battleground today. As you're speaking, Bitcoin's around 37,600. So it's going to be a big tug and pull trying to battle over that price. Pretty much at this point, I believe that I saw $350 million will get liquidated either way, depending on what side of the pendulum the price falls on at the end of the day today. So it's a lot of volatility you'll probably see in the crypto market today. Usually when that happens at the end of the month, it kind of subsides over the weekend, and you'll get back to kind of an even keel of where the price is going to be. But Bitcoin right now has been hovering between 31,000 and 40,000. That's kind of been its range. There's a lot of good bullish things that are happening for crypto. There's some bearish things. You know, you have some regulation coming out from the executive office of the president. Joe Biden has announced he's going to take some executive action in terms of regulating crypto as a means of national security, he says. I don't see why cryptocurrency is a threat to national security, but when governments tend to talk about crypto, they tend to over-sensationalize its impact in terms of it's going to be so terrible for society, it's going to be so terrible for this, terrible for that, we need to rein it in, we need to control it. The reason that they're scared of cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin in particular and anything else that's truly decentralized is because it's decentralized. It means that there's no single person that has control of it. There's no group in control of it. If you look at Bitcoin, Bitcoin is fully decentralized. There is no head of Bitcoin. There's no CEO of Bitcoin. There is no king of Bitcoin. Bitcoin, anybody can mine Bitcoin. Bitcoin is pretty much governed by the miners, and anybody can mine. Anybody can mine Bitcoin, right? So that takes the power out of a central authority and makes it decentralized. And that decentralization is what government fears. Matter of fact, some more bearish news. El Salvador asked the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, for a loan of around $1 billion, I believe. And the IMF told El Salvador, which is the first and only country to make Bitcoin an additional legal tender to what they currently have, that they'll only give them the loan if they make Bitcoin illegal and not a legal tender, right? So what has the International Monetary Fund so scared of Bitcoin, right? Why are they so afraid of it? You know, that really begs the question. It's really just an alternative system of hard money. And by hard money, I mean that it's capped, it can't be inflated, that people can opt to using. It gives people more freedom, but they're so terrified of that because there's no control in it. It's good for the individual, but it's terrible if you're a government. And that really has them scared. So it's going to be curious to see what's going to happen. I'm curious to see if El Salvador will stick to his guns or really pander because they really need that money. It's kind of tough because El Salvador is still a developing nation in terms of their third world economy. And they're trying to do, their president's trying to do what's best, he think, in his mind for his country. I can't tell you making Bitcoin legal tender will for sure solve all that country's woes. I think it could help. I think having more options is better than having less, especially something, Bitcoin, which is international. You can send Bitcoin to anybody, to anywhere in a matter of minutes. It doesn't go through any third party. It's all self-contained. You don't need the approval of anybody. You don't need to have something sitting in an escrow. You know, all you need is a wallet, and they need a wallet. That's it. And that's what has people scared. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. Another interesting news, as we know, Russia and the Ukraine have been in a lot of the forefront of a lot of news, at least crypto-related information there. Well, I'll say stock-related information, too. We'll start with the crypto since we're talking about it. Crypto-related news there. Ukraine, I believe, mines. This is the 10th largest country by miners, Bitcoin miners. So why that interesting? Why is that interesting? Well, Russia, their central banks that came out and said that they would like to ban crypto mining. That was earlier this week. Well, Vladimir Putin just came out and said that, on the contrary, he wants Bitcoin mining. He wants crypto mining to be in Russia especially in places where there is a low demand for electricity and electricity is cheap. He says he thinks it could stimulate their economy and be good for Russia. So he's pretty much told the central banks, you need to step down. We want Bitcoin mining, right? I think he sees the value in Bitcoin. I think he sees it going up. And I think he sees if they can get a foothold into that mining, continue to grow their footprint in that mining arena, it'd be beneficial and net benefit for his country, right? But why is that also important is I don't say this is the reason they're invading Ukraine, but it's also interesting that Ukraine has a lot of miners there. A lot of miners are in Ukraine because when China banned, they went over to Ukraine. Ukraine has cheap electricity. They have crypto-friendly laws. So a lot of miners went to Ukraine too. So it would be interesting, not saying that that is the reason Russia is invading Ukraine, because it's not, and we're not a geopolitics podcast, but it's just interesting to note, you know. It's just something interesting, maybe not important, but something interesting to note. On the stock side, if you know one sector that has been kind of up this whole year is the energy sector. And the reason the energy sector is up, because another thing that Russia has, we all know, is oil and natural gas. Actually, Russia supplies a lot of natural gas to a lot of the Western European. So when you look at it from that landscape, Russia's threatening Ukraine, the Western European countries who are all part of NATO are saying, hey, don't do that. There'll be actions, there'll be consequences, there'll be sanctions. Well, one of the things that Russia does is, like, I give you your gas, I give you your natural gas, I give you a lot of your oil. So now we're in a situation where that perceived tension between Russia and the rest of the world is causing prices in the energy sector to go higher, especially between oil and natural gas. So those are two sectors of the economy. Matter of fact, I bought a position XLE, which is a ETF that tracks several companies that are in the oil and natural gas industry and the overall energy industry. And I bought that just for that reason, just because I wanted some exposure knowing the tensions that are happening there. And that's sometimes where it pays off to know some of the politics and geopolitics are happening around the world. Stay informed of that and see how that can actually affect you and how that you can use that. And, you know, that can be essentially a candle in the darkness. Otherwise, everything else is going down since the beginning of the year. That's the only thing that's really been going up is that energy sector. So that's a good thing to kind of keep in mind if you're looking at it from a financial perspective. You know, of course, we wouldn't want war. We wouldn't want anything like that. That would be, you know, terrible for the overall loss of life in economies, you know, here and abroad. So we're hoping that that resolves itself. But you see how these things kind of fall in line and how things are so connected on the world stage and how that can kind of directly affect you. You're seeing it now, too. You're seeing that gas prices started going down a little bit, but now they're coming rising back up. I can expect that to, you know, you should expect to continue to see that until we have some kind of conclusion to this whole Russia-Ukraine fiasco. But other than that, that's pretty much your market recap for this week. I predict pretty much until March, we're probably going to be just as choppy this week like we were this week for every other week leading up until March. I know that's not good news. That's another 8 weeks of hell. But, you know, the markets don't like uncertainty. And the Fed has not guaranteed when it's going to raise rates and exactly how much those rate increases will be. And those are two very big uncertainties that really have the market spook right now. And that's one thing the markets don't like is not having guarantees on something that important, what's going to happen with that. So until we get some certainty in that arena, expect things to be choppy. Things could continue to go deeper into a bearish market. I will hope that they don't, but they could. Bearish markets tend to last anywhere from 5, right, to 15 months based off historical bearish markets. But that doesn't mean it couldn't go a lot longer than 15 months. It doesn't mean it could be shorter than 5. But those are just some kind of the historical average of how long it usually takes to get out of a bear market. And, you know, some bear markets, there's been bear markets that's lasted close to a decade, right? We're hoping we're not going to be in that, but we'll see. You know, you still have companies smashing expectations. I believe Apple was 11%, beat earnings by 11% earnings estimates. That's ridiculous. I mean, Apple is really making money hand over fist. It's almost shocking how well they're able to do that. They smashed expectations, right? Apple is, you know, off the strength of Apple's earnings, they pretty much kept the S&P afloat because they were one of the few ones that were up. While a lot of other companies posted their earnings and they dropped, Apple actually went up in price. And that's kind of a testament to the power of Apple. It's really one of the most, you know, not financial advisors, not financial advice, but that's one of the blue chip things that would be prudent to have in your portfolio. If you're in any kind of index fund of the S&P 500 or any NASDAQ or tech stocks, I guarantee Apple's in it, right? Any index fund or any ETF is going to track that because Apple is just the Mac daddy of them all. It's literally the most valuable company in the world. Think about that. The most valuable company in the entire world is Apple. So we'll be curious to see what they're going to do. I think they came out and said that in their follow-up, they said that they feel like the supply chain issues will ease for them this year, which is against what some analysts thought. So, they could do it again next quarter. We'll see. We'll definitely see. But thanks for listening. Please like, subscribe. Rate if you can. We really appreciate it. I'll post my trades and what I do. I might be a little bit more bullish in the delta in my calls for selling this week, just because the market's been so sideways and down. I don't see a big rally happening until after that March meeting, but you never know. But I'll post what calls I sell on Monday. Usually, I do most of my trades on Monday. And so look on our Instagram for that. And thank you for listening. We appreciate it. And talk to you next time.